Plenty of firms need typists, and more women have become secretaries of late. I can type. I've practiced shorthand on my own for when I'd have to transcribe at school. I'm qualified for many positions. Livia squeezed her eyes shut for a moment. The idea of Charlotte's flight into the wilds of London was utterly overwhelming. I don't doubt your qualifications, but then there's nothing to fear. Charlotte stepped out of her summery frock and reached for a travelling dress of russet velvet. I'll be fine. I should have done this long ago, as soon as I came of age. But Charlotte, how much money do you have? A few pounds won't get you very far if you don't find employment right away. Livia hoarded the minuscule allowance she received from Lady Holmes, but Charlotte had a tendency to spend hers on books, bonbons, and odds and ends like a typewriter or a chemistry set. If she had more than £5 to her name, Livia would be shocked. I'll be fine, Livia. I expect the process to move quickly. There wouldn't be the woman question if it were so easy for a female to leave her home and achieve independence. Granted, Charlotte's mind had to be one of the finest in the land, but she was and would forever be a woman who had lost her respectability, a pariah. That had to be a monumental impediment, even away from the froth and vanity of the upper 10,000. That said, Charlotte's steely confidence was inspiring. Good old Charlotte, who knew everything, observed everything, and deduced the rest, if there were still anything left to be deduced. If anyone could succeed at this mad endeavour and live, no, prosper, to thumb her nose at her hide-bound parents, it would be Charlotte Holmes. However, at the thought of their parents, what about Mama and Papa? What will they do once they learn that you've run away? Mama will be hysterical. Papa will be furious. Mama will wish to tear the city apart to find me so she can slap me some more. Papa will agree with her initially that I should be brought home to be firmly dealt with. But whether he decides to confide his troubles to the police or a private investigator before he's dressed to go out, he'll change his mind. Why should he take the trouble to haul me home when I'll most likely run away again? Why not let me be defeated by London and life outside his sphere of protection? That way, when I come knocking in helpless despair, he'll be sure I'll stay put in the country for the rest of my life. Livia clutched at her temples. That's heartless! That's logical, and our father considers himself a clever man. Besides, Charlotte marched to the window and peered out, straightening her cuffs as she did so. Mott's here. It's time. While Mott secured Charlotte's luggage to the top of the carriage, Charlotte said her goodbyes to Bernardine. Livia wasn't sure whether she would have taken the trouble. All Bernardine ever did was spin things. Spools on a wire, wooden gears, paper windmills. She never spoke to anyone, and Livia sometimes wondered if she could distinguish members of her family from strangers on the street. She watched Charlotte with Bernardine, but only for a moment. It always made her both dejected and angry, at God himself, perhaps, to see the futility of anyone trying to interact with Bernardine. Charlotte was less bothered by Bernardine's condition and spoke to her softly and calmly, an adult to another adult. Livia waited in the passage until Charlotte was done. Then she accompanied her sister to the carriage and climbed in first. If you think I'll limit myself to saying goodbye here, I never thought that. During the ride, Charlotte told Livia about the registries and societies that helped women find employment, lodging, and companionship, which was somewhat heartening. Livia had no idea there were so many resources available. But all too soon they came to a stop before the hotel where Charlotte would spend the night. Panic assailed Livia. She gripped Charlotte's wrists. Are you sure, Charlotte? Are you sure you can do this? Charlotte nodded. In the light from the carriage lanterns, she seemed to be made of granite, all cool, solid strength. Livia pressed a small pouch into her hand. Take this. In the pouch were a crumpled pound note, several shillings, and three pairs of gold earrings. This is all the money I brought with me to London. I have more in my bank account. If you're in trouble, let me know. I'll funnel you funds. Charlotte blinked several times in rapid succession and looked as if she wanted to say something, but in the end she only embraced Livia. I'll be absolutely fine. You'll see. So rushed, their goodbyes, so complete, the silence and emptiness of the carriage. Livia stared at the sidewalks, crowded with wide-eyed tourists and insouciant young men in evening attire, strolling toward their next venue of diversion. Her mind was sinking into a dark place. Sister, companion, refuge, hope. Charlotte was everything Livia had in life. Now she was gone, and Livia had nothing. Nothing at all. The carriage took a turn. A few more minutes and she would be back at the house her parents had hired for the season, where there would be more silence and greater emptiness. She would be alone. She would be alone for the rest of eternity. Before she knew it, she'd yanked hard on the bell pull.
Yes, miss,
came Mott's voice through the speaking slot. I'm not going home, she said. I have a different destination in mind. 5. The pain behind Livia's forehead corroded the backs of her eyes. Her tongue felt as if she'd used it to clean the grate, and when she tried to move, it became clear that a maniacal sprite was drilling holes into her temples. It was morning and she'd spent the night in the guest room, in order to be able to lie more convincingly about not knowing when Charlotte had escaped. She kept dreaming of Charlotte's sweet, sad face, and for some reason, Charlotte's features insisted on turning into Lady Shrewsbury's, all pinched lips and jutting cheekbones. Livia had screamed at the hateful woman for ruining Charlotte's life, for ruining all their lives. Groaning, Livia staggered out of bed. She needed to go down and delay her parents' discovery of Charlotte's absence for as long as possible. She barely made it to the top of the stairs when Lady Holmes stomped up, a wild expression on her face.
You will never guess what happened!
Her voice scratched across Livia's skull. A wave of nausea pounded her.
What happened?
Had Lady Holmes already found out that Charlotte was gone?
Lady Shrewsbury is dead.
Livia braced a hand on the newel post. Her incredulity shot through with an incipient dread.
How can that be? They found her expired early this morning. The doctor's already been and declared it an aneurysm of the brain. I think it's divine justice. The way she came and shoved all the blame on us, when it was her own son who was the cad and the bounder, she deserved it.
Livia shuddered at her mother's callousness.
I don't believe the Almighty strikes anyone dead solely for being petty, or even hypocritical. I happen to be convinced that sometimes he does.
Lady Holmes's tone was triumphant.
And maybe this is the year he smites those who have been thorns in my side.
It took Livia a moment to realize that Lady Holmes was referring to Lady Amelia Drummond. That name had never been brought up in the Holmes household, certainly not in Livia's hearing. But Lady Amelia's abrupt death, she'd been in perfect health and vigor only the day before, had been quite the topic of gossip for the past fortnight. Lady Holmes shoved past Lydia.
Wait, is that all you know?
Are there no other details?
Lady Holmes stopped and thought for a moment. Then she snorted.
Mrs. Neely said Roger Shrewsbury is devastated. Said he is sure his disgrace sent his mother into an early grave. How typical of a man to think the world revolves around him. Wait, is...
Lady Holmes marched on in the direction of Livia and Charlotte's room.
When will you learn to be quiet, Olivia? I have other things to do than standing there and answering your questions, especially today.
The silence, as Lady Holmes threw open the door, was thunderous. Her question, when it came at last, deafened.
Where is Charlotte?
Charlotte had been everywhere in London this day, or at least it felt that way to her throbbing feet. By mid-morning, she, or rather Miss Caroline Holmes from Tunbridge, typist, had secured a room at Mrs. Wallace's boarding house, a very respectable place at a very respectable location near Cavendish Square. The rest of her first day of freedom was spent whittling away at her scant funds. She was obliged to acquire a tea kettle, a chipped tea service, a spirit lamp on which to heat water, silverware and flatware, tooth powder, towels, and bed linens, plus a number of other miscellany that a young woman accustomed to living at her parents' house never needed to worry about. She tried to think of her purchases as an investment for the future, for when she and Livia, and Bernardine too, would have a place of their own and direction over their collective existence. But that dream was taking its last laboured breaths, wasn't it? All alone in a ditch somewhere? Bernardine might not care much one way or the other, but Livia. Livia, who was so proud, so fragile, and so constantly doubtful of herself. Livia, who mistrusted humanity yet feared being alone. Charlotte had been Livia's companion. She listened when Livia wanted to talk, and remained quiet when Livia wanted to hear herself think. And Charlotte, too, had been a target of Lady Holmes's wrath, with her refusal of proposal after proposal. But now Livia was unsupported and unshielded. Now she was all alone before both a scornful society and a pair of livid parents with no other outlet for their anger. Charlotte passed Cavendish Square, the trees and shrubs of which were dingy with soot. The air in London had always been terrible, but far more so for a woman who must walk all day long than one who had a carriage at her disposal. By midday, as she stood before the mirror in her new room at Mrs. Wallace's, the top of her ruffled collar was already marked by a ring of grime on the inside. She didn't want to think of its advanced state of soil after several more hours out and about. Turning on to Wimpole Street, she made a stop at Atwell and Dewsbury, pharmaceutical chemists. Mrs. Wallace had recommended the place for the purchase of incidentals. Charlotte had visited the shop earlier in the day to buy bathing soap and matches, and to take a look at the selection of books that customers could borrow for a penny apiece. But of course she hadn't thought of everything. This time Mr. Atwell kindly sold her some stationery, and a package of 100 perforated pieces of tissue for the water closet, wrapped in brown paper, and without either of them ever mentioning it by name. As she stepped out of the shop, a dapper older gentleman sauntered past on the opposite side of the street. He looked so much like Sir Henry, she came to a dead halt. Had she been angrier at him or herself? The latter, most likely. Livia had warned her repeatedly not to trust their father's promises. But she had been deaf to those warnings, willfully deaf. Not that she thought Sir Henry the kind of paragon he most emphatically wasn't, but because she believed that her good opinion and goodwill meant something to him. They probably did, but not enough in the end to make any difference. Mrs. Wallace's place was around the corner.
When Charlotte walked in, most of the boarders were milling about in the common room, socializing before supper.
"I'll bet the girl's mum is having a right laugh this minute," said a vivacious brunette. "Goodness knows I would, if the old woman what caught my daughter and acted so hoity-toity about it is found dead the next morning."
Charlotte's ears heated, as if a curling iron had been held too close.
"You don't think the girl's family had something to do with it?" said another woman.
She was no more than 21 and looked excitable.
"Which old woman?"
asked Charlotte. The brunette turned toward her.
"You must be the new girl. Miss Holmes, is it?"
she asked, her demeanour friendly.
"Yes, nice to meet you, Miss..."
"Whitbread, Nan Whitbread, and this is Miss Spooner."
They all shook hands.
"I didn't mean to interrupt, but what you were talking about sounded fascinating."
"Oh, it is. My cousin works at one of the fancy dressmakers on Regent Street," said Miss Whitbread. "And she kept hearing about it all day from the clients. They weren't talking to her, of course, but among themselves. About the lady what caught her married son having a go at this young lady, hung the young lady out to dry, and then woke up dead the next morning."
"Lady Shrewsbury was dead?"
"Dead? Oh my," Charlotte mumbled. "Just like that?"
"That's what they say. Can't remember the name for it. The condition what makes you bleed in the head."
"An aneurysm of the brain?" Charlotte supplied.
"Sounds about right. First-rate story, ain't it? Oh, I mean, isn't it?"
Miss Whitbread lowered her voice.
"Mrs. Wallace don't like us using ain't around here. Says it isn't ladylike."
"And if you got a young man who's sweet on you, don't ever mention it to her or Miss Turner," added Miss Spooner. "We aren't supposed to have any gentleman friends at all."
"Especially not a young man like Miss Spooner's. He takes her out to tea shops and feeds her suppers," said Miss Whitbread with a wink.
"Shh," warned Miss Spooner, laughter and alarm alike dancing in her eyes.
"Speak of the devil."
Mrs. Wallace came into the common room. She was in her mid-30s. A tall, broad-shouldered woman with a clear look of authority. Behind her followed a thin, short woman who must be at least 5 years older, but was obviously a lieutenant, rather than the captain. Miss Turner, then. Mrs. Wallace greeted her boarders and introduced Charlotte. The company duly proceeded to the dining room, where Miss Turner said grace, and the women helped themselves to a supper of boiled bacon cheek and vegetable marrow. Charlotte's meals were very important to her, but this evening she noticed nothing of the food she put in her mouth. With half an ear she listened to Miss Whitbread tell her about the rules and customs of the house. The only question she asked was,
"Do you think I'd be allowed to go out and buy a newspaper?"
"Oh, you don't need to. Mrs. Wallace don't like any of us going out after supper, so she has the evening paper delivered."
When Charlotte reached the common room after supper, Miss Turner already had the evening paper in hand. She read aloud from its pages as the other women knitted, mended hose, wrote letters, or played games of draughts.
"Now listen to this advert, ladies. Seeking sincerely and urgently girl infant left behind on the doorsteps of Westminster Cathedral on the night of the 23rd of November, 1861.
Miss Turner peered over the top of the paper at the other occupants of the room.
"This is why you must always be careful and not be led astray, or the same could happen to you. Become a sorry woman looking for her child, 25 years too late."
The date sounded familiar. Charlotte searched her memory and recalled that there had been an awful pea souper on that day in 1861. She sincerely doubted anyone would choose to venture out in such weather to abandon a baby of all things,
but she didn't say anything. At precisely 9 o'clock, Miss Turner laid aside the paper. All the other women rose and prepared to vacate the room. Charlotte took the paper.
"Miss Holmes, lights out is at 9:30, said Miss Turner officiously. You should not read past that.
I won't, Charlotte promised. In her room, a small but faultlessly clean space, she quickly found the death notice for Lady Shrewsbury. So Lady Shrewsbury truly was dead, when she'd been energetic and vigorous only the day before. Lady Shrewsbury had seemed a great deal more upset at Charlotte than at her own son. But could she have been furious about him, rather than merely peeved? Could that fury have led to her perishing in her slumber? Charlotte rubbed her temples, wishing she'd bought a cache of foodstuffs. The portions at supper might have been enough for a woman of smaller appetites, but Charlotte had never been one of those women. What was really going on? And would people think Charlotte might have had something to do with it?
Charlotte, you liar! You swore up and down that all would be well, that you would have no trouble landing a post in short order. How inebriated I must have been to have taken you at your word. I have since skimmed through your stacks of books and magazines having to do with female employment. I ended my reading with a pounding headache and a heart that cannot sink any lower. The vast majority of avenues open to gentlewomen seeking work are for those who already possess the necessary educational and professional qualifications, of which you have none. And those other opportunities you mentioned? Most require a period of apprenticeship, for which you have to pay a premium with money you do not have. The only positions that do not demand either education or apprenticeship pay so little they are only suitable for young girls working to supplement the family income, not for a grown woman trying to live on her own. And I have not even brought up the Working Ladies' Guild, which you described as so very helpful. It requires that a member personally vouch for you before you can seek employment via its registry. May the Almighty strike me dead for saying this to my own sister, but Charlotte, no woman alive will risk her respectability to recommend you to any association or employer. Not any more. Not ever. You knew all this, and you lied through your teeth, and I aided and abetted you in this hopeless venture. If I had shoved you in front of an oncoming omnibus, I could not have done worse as your sister. Oh, what have you done, Charlotte? What have we done?
Livia.
P.S. I wrote the above shortly before luncheon, but have not been able to leave the house to post it. I hope I will have better luck in the afternoon.
P.P.S.
You were right about our parents' reactions. Mama was in a state and Papa coldly angry, and he changed his mind after first saying he would bring you back exactly as you had predicted.
P.P.P.S.
As you instructed, I told them I did not know when or how you had left. I said I had too much to drink and went to bed early in a stupor, and you must have stolen out at night. I do not know how much Mama and Papa believe me. They questioned Mott, too, and Mott turned out to be a tremendous liar. He looked them in the eye, and his expression remained frank and naive throughout.
P.P.P.P.S.
Mama has forbidden me to leave the house. I will try to entrust this letter to Mott.
P.P.P.P.P.S.
An awful realization. If I cannot leave the house, then I cannot withdraw any money from the bank. Charlotte, promise me you will not let yourself starve to death on the streets, or worse. No, forget that. There is no worse fate than your starving to death on the streets. Do not let your pride be your end. If things go ill, come home. Please.
Charlotte met Miss Whitbread, who carried a heavy-looking satchel outside Mrs. Wallace's.
"Why, hello, Miss Holmes," said Miss Whitbread. "Back home early?"
Yes, Charlotte answered, opening the door for Miss Whitbread. I have my own typewriter, and the firm doesn't mind if I brought some work home. Charlotte had always been a good liar. According to Livia, her expression didn't change at all as she slipped between truths, having her own typewriter, for example, and falsehoods, in this case having a firm that paid her for clacking away at said typewriter. That's capital. I'm doing the same here, bringing work home. Charlotte remembered that Miss Whitbread painted silks and cards for a living. My employer's got only the shop on the Strand. Everybody who works for him takes their pieces home. It's nice in a way, but to tell you the truth, I wouldn't mind if he had a studio somewhere, so I've a place to go during the day and people to see. Yes, staying put in your room all day can become tedious. Charlotte didn't mind it so much, but Livia became antsy if she couldn't get out for a daily walk. That and not having anyone around for a good chin-wag till supper. Miss Whitbread set her satchel on a chair in the empty common room and rolled her shoulders. That's why I stopped to see my cousin today. We had a cup of tea and she gave me the latest about the scandal. Charlotte's hand tightened on her reticule. Do tell. Miss Whitbread needed no further prompting. You won't believe it. Apparently the girl's sister had a flaming row with the dead woman only hours before she died. A flaming row. They said she told the woman to her face that she, even more than her son, deserved to die for ruining her sister's life. Charlotte felt as if she'd been hit in the stomach by a cricket bat. Oh, dear, she said, praying her suitable interested face was holding together. That's what I said, Miss Whitbread nodded sagely. I told my cousin Abby this is going to be interesting before long. Real interesting. The moment Charlotte had finished reading Livia's letter, a weight had settled in her stomach. Not because of Livia's dismay and anxiety at the realities of Charlotte's employment prospects, but because the former had not said a word about Lady Shrewsbury's death. Now she knew why. Just as she had concealed the truth from Livia, Livia was concealing the truth from her. She didn't believe Livia would be in any trouble from the law. Even if the Shrewsburys suspected that something might be awry, they would not let matters proceed to an inquest, where, under questioning, Roger Shrewsbury's seduction of a virgin he could not possibly marry would become a matter of public record, carried in all the papers of the land. Lady Shrewsbury would return from the dead first. But Livia did not need to be wanted for murder to suffer. If rumours and speculations persisted long enough, society would come to believe that she had something to do with Lady Shrewsbury's death, and that would be enough for her to become marginalised, if not outright ostracised. At least, this time, Charlotte had some food on hand. She had asked for an extra sandwich when she'd bought her lunch, and also some apricots sold at a discount because they'd been bruised during their travels. She finished the sandwich first, washing it down with a cup of weak tea. The apricots came wrapped in crumpled newspaper. By habit, she scanned the columns of print. Her eyes widened. She read the small article again, this time more attentively. Mr. Harrington Sackville, of Curry House, Stanwell Moot, was found unconscious yesterday morning from an apparent overdose of chloral. Unfortunately, he could not be revived and was pronounced dead on the scene. He was a well-respected gentleman, said to have been in good health and spirits before his passing. An inquest will be held in 2 days. Charlotte frowned. She had very few talents that her mother found useful. In fact, she had only two. One, she knew most of Burke's peerage by heart. Two, after her first season in London, she developed a clear understanding of the myriad alliances and sometimes enmities that connected those families listed in Burke's. Therefore, she knew exactly who Mr. Harrington Sackville was, and how he was related to two others who had also passed away recently and abruptly, and whose deaths were even more inexplicable than his. Maybe she could yet do something to break the siege for Livia. She sat down and pulled out a piece of stationery she'd bought at Atwell and Dewsbury, pharmaceutical chemists. 6.
Ash, called Roger Shrewsbury. Ash, a minute of your time, please.
Lord Ingram Ashburton turned around.
What can I do for you, Mr. Shrewsbury?
They had known each other since they were children. Lord Ingram had never called his old school chum Mr. Shrewsbury, except when he presented the latter in formal introduction. Shrewsbury swallowed. He understood the rebuke for what it was. He understood that Lord Ingram no longer considered him a friend. They were at the private cemetery on the Shrewsbury estate, on a high bluff above an inlet of River Fowl, not far from the southern coast of Cornwall. Overhead, the sky lowered ominously. Rain was imminent. Lady Shrewsbury was already in the ground, and the mourners were fast dispersing, hoping to find shelter before the storm unleashed. Shrewsbury hesitated. Lord Ingram did not further prompt him. Shrewsbury's gloved hand opened and closed around the top of his walking stick, opened and closed again. One of their classmates walked by and inclined his head. They both nodded in return. Thunder rumbled, then cracked. Shrewsbury jumped. Lord Ingram remained stock still. Shrewsbury cleared his throat.
Ash, that is, my lord.
He had never before called Lord Ingram my lord except jokingly. But this was no jest. This was Shrewsbury acknowledging his new place. That of a mere acquaintance no longer accorded the privilege of addressing Lord Ingram as an intimate.
My lord, I wonder if you would, possibly be so kind as to pass on a word for me.
Lord Ingram only looked at him. Shrewsbury put a hand at the back of his neck and cleared his throat again.
You see, I feel terrible about what happened. I feel even worse now that I heard Miss Charlotte Holmes has run off on her own. Most of London is no place for a genteelly brought-up young lady. It's bone-chilling, thinking about the mishaps that could befall her. I want to help, or at least mitigate my part in the whole fiasco. But I can't approach her family or any of her lady friends, you know how it is. So I thought, well, perhaps she might come to you for aid. You two used to be thick as thieves, even if that was a while ago.
I have not heard from Miss Holmes since the fiasco, said Lord Ingram.
But you might in the future, mightn't you? If you do, please let her know that I'll be more than happy to put her up in a safe place and, well, look after her.
And how would she reciprocate your kindness?
Lord Ingram's words were even, almost good-natured.
She was willing to be my paramour before. I
assume that hasn't changed.
I see, said Lord Ingram, his tone even more kindly.
Should Miss Holmes seek my help, I will remember to point her in your direction. Would that be all?
Roger Shrewsbury's throat moved.
I know you want to punch me. Why don't you? Go ahead.
Lord Ingram lifted a surprised brow.
Mr. Shrewsbury, I'm a married man. I don't know about Mrs. Shrewsbury, but Lady Ingram would not care to hear that I brawled over another woman.
Roger Shrewsbury flushed to the tops of his ears.
Of course, of course. Please forgive me.
Lord Ingram nodded.
My condolences.
He turned and walked away. Roger Shrewsbury would never know how close he had come to being thrashed within an inch of his life. Lord Ingram looked up from his cufflinks.
Yes, Cummings. I've saved the article on Mr. Holmes from the paper, said his valet. May I assume you'll have no more use for the rest of it, my lord?
Lord Ingram stilled. He had purchased a West Country paper before his return journey, which had sat next to him on the train, unread, as he stared out of the window for hours on end. He vaguely recalled leaving Paddington Station with the paper in hand.
You may dispose of the paper as you see fit.
Very good, sir. I have left the article in your dressing room.
Lord Ingram waited until his valet had left, before heading to the dressing room. Cummings handled the posting and collection of his correspondence from time to time, so it wasn't surprising that he would remember Sherlock Holmes. But why in the world was there an article about Holmes in the paper? A West Country paper, no less. The newspaper clipping had for its headline, "Inquest adjourned, awaiting further evidence." Lord Ingram frowned as he read the opening account of Mr. Harrington Sackville's death. Sackville. He had heard the name in passing at Lady Shrewsbury's funeral. Lord Sheridan's long-lost brother, whom no one had seen for many years. Lord Ingram didn't know the man, but the general reaction seemed to have been surprise of the "so he was still alive as of recently" variety. Inquest testimonies from physicians and Sackville's household retainers were recorded verbatim in the paper. Everything seemed more or less straightforward, and nothing had anything to do with Sherlock Holmes. Had Cummings clipped the wrong article? At the end of witness testimonies, the coroner read the following letter from Mr. Sherlock Holmes of London. Lord Ingram swore.
Dear sir, it has come to my attention that Mr. Harrington Sackville's death, by apparent overdose of chloral, may not be an isolated incident. Lady Amelia Drummond preceded him in death by a week and a half. The Dowager Baroness Shrewsbury followed a mere 24 hours later. Lady Amelia was first cousin to Mr. Sackville's elder brother by the same father, Lord Sheridan, and godmother to one of Baroness Shrewsbury's children. All three deaths were unforeseen. As was true in Mr. Sackville's case, Lady Amelia and Lady Shrewsbury, too, had been in excellent health and spirits. They all perished overnight. The only difference is that Mr. Sackville's maid came across him while he still drew breaths, albeit weakly, which gave the household sufficient time to fetch a physician, and for the physician to diagnose an overdose of chloral, even if that diagnosis came too late for anything to be done. Had the maid not tried to rouse him, he would have been found dead, and the cause of death would most likely have been given as failure of the heart or an aneurysm of the brain, causes set down on the death certificates of Lady Amelia Drummond and Lady Shrewsbury, respectively. And his passing, however unexpected, would have been treated much in the same manner as theirs, attracting its share of gossip and speculation, but no legal notice. Each death, taken singly, may be accepted as unfortunate but not suspicious. However, the proximity of all three, not only in time, but in their social and familial connection, becomes difficult to ignore. I urge you, sir, to share this intelligence with your jury. Yours truly, Sherlock Holmes. Lord Ingram swore again. By tomorrow the news would be in all the London rags. Holmes never once mentioned the word, but how long before speculations leaped from mere suspicious deaths to the most conspiratorial of murders? He didn't want to imagine the bedlam that would be unleashed. Was this circus but a sleight of hand on Holmes's part, to draw the glare of unwanted attention away from a certain beleaguered relation? No. If a diversion had been all that was required, Holmes would have accomplished it without provoking a public uproar.
He read the letter again, pressing two fingers against the center of his forehead. Holmes believed that something was wrong. Believed it enough to write from the wasteland of exile, in the hope of influencing the outcome of the inquest. Lord Ingram closed his eyes, but it was no use. He was too accustomed to giving Holmes everything he could, always with a sense of urgency, and a sense of futility. What Holmes wanted most was beyond his power. Some people never meet the right person in life. They, on the other hand, met when they were too young to realize what they had found in each other. And when they did at last see the light, it was too late. He tossed aside the newspaper clipping and headed for the front door.
My lord!
Inspector Treddles found himself a little uncertain at the appearance of Lord Ingram in his parlour. It wasn't yet late, but it was after dinner, and he hadn't anticipated any social visits, let alone one from his lordship. Lord Ingram inclined his head.
Mrs. Treddles, Inspector, I hope I haven't disturbed you in your hour of repose.
Of course not. Alice rose from her seat and shook Lord Ingram's hand. Do please sit down and let us know what brought you here.
This brought me here.
Lord Ingram handed over a largish newspaper clipping that had been carefully folded.
If you will do me the honour of reading the article to the end.
Alice rang for tea. Then she and Treddles sat down with the article. They gasped at almost the same time upon the first mention of Sherlock Holmes. Treddles sucked in another breath as he reached the conclusion of the letter.
Does this mean that Holmes is well again? He asked. Or is this from before his misfortune? I have no way of ascertaining. Holmes remains beyond reach.
Lord Ingram's gaze strayed to the mantel and lingered on a photograph of the Treddleses and himself, taken on the Isles of Scilly, in those days when Holmes was only a quick note away.
But it doesn't take a mind of extraordinary calibre to deduce that this must be important to Holmes. I understand Mr. Sackville's death took place outside the Metropolitan Police's district of authority, but I also understand that it is not unusual for county police to request help from the CID, especially in case of suspicious deaths, where there isn't enough local expertise to handle the investigation.
He looked back at Treddles.
Inspector, may I ask that you personally inquire into the matter?
Treddles glanced at his wife, who gave a small nod.
Certainly, my lord. I will send a cable to some friends serving with the Devon Constabulary first thing tomorrow morning.
Lord Ingram exhaled.
Thank you, Inspector. I am most obliged.
My dear Lord Ingram, as soon as I arrived in Scotland Yard this morning, I learned that the Devon Constabulary has requested assistance from the CID with regard to Mr. Sackville's case. I have volunteered my services. I can only hope I shall not disappoint Sherlock Holmes. Your servant, Robert Treddles.
7.
No letters for you, miss, said the post office clerk to Charlotte.
Charlotte thanked him, yielded her place, and walked across the cavernous impersonal interior of the post office. She was fine until she reached the third pillar from the door, and then her lungs collapsed. She couldn't breathe. She couldn't move. Her nails dug into the palms of her hands as she broke out in a cold sweat. Imminent heart failure. She recognized all the symptoms. Dear God, what would happen to Livia? And what would the man she couldn't stop caring about think? When he learned that she'd met her end at the General Post Office on St. Martin's Le Grand, of all places. 2 minutes later, still very much on her feet and not lying in a heap on the floor,
she began to realize that what ailed her wasn't the spear point of mortality, but the onset of panic. She had never felt panic in her life. Livia sometimes did, when she imagined, in excruciating detail, ending up an indigent old maid unwanted by any and all relations, spending her days in a grimy boarding house, subsisting on only bread and boiled cabbage. When Livia fell into one of her states of uncontrolled anxiety, or climbed into one, as Charlotte sometimes thought, Charlotte would bring her a heaping plate of buttered toast and hot tea laced with brandy. She would rub Livia's back, and then she would read aloud passages from Jane Eyre, Livia's favourite book, a work Charlotte couldn't otherwise get through, finding it too dense with high emotion and melodrama. But even though she did all these sisterly things, she never did feel any of Livia's fear and anguish. It had seemed utterly incomprehensible that a future decades distant, built of nothing but worst-case scenarios, should hold such sway over the here and now. Until this moment. Until the weight of all her choices descended upon her with the force and tonnage of a landslide. What if the investigation into Mr. Sackville's death unearthed nothing? What if the truth remained obscured, and Livia was forever branded an unprosecuted murderer because of a drunken spat? Fear swelled, crushing her organs to make room for more of itself. It squeezed the air out of her lungs. It coiled python-like around her stomach. It forced its way up her windpipe, pushing, expanding, blocking every last sliver of open passage. She'd always been certain that she'd be able to take care of Livia in addition to herself. She never thought she would wreck both their lives simultaneously. She had not made up out of whole cloth the more numerous opportunities open to women these days. Nor had she conjured from thin air those societies that existed to connect women in need of employment with employers in need of positions filled. But a good portion of those organizations, for all their good and noble intentions, were thinly funded. Two of those she visited had already closed permanently, with another still nominally in operation, but taking applications only by post. The ones that appeared to be in more robust shape all required letters of character written by ladies of good standing. Those Charlotte would never have, but those didn't concern her so much. She was passable at imitating handwriting and did not consider it a moral failing for a woman in her situation to forge her own recommendations. Of a far greater worry was that to receive help from those societies, she had to first pay a subscription fee, which her already thin wallet could ill afford, not if she wanted to eat and have a roof over her head too. And then, were she determined enough to pay the fee, she could expect to wait weeks, possibly months, before a suitable position turned up. She didn't have that kind of time. It wasn't so dire yet. Not at the moment. But just as Livia looked down the years and saw nothing but misery and loneliness at the end of the road, Charlotte could not get rid of this stone-hard dread of coming to the last of her pennies. Her room and board was 9 shillings 6 a week. After paying for the first 2 weeks, she had £5.3 and 10 left, including what Livia had given her. That amount had been further reduced after the purchase of the daily necessities, not to mention she had to provide for her own lunches. The money would not last forever. It would not even last very long. And then what? If she couldn't look after herself, how would she begin to help Livia?
"Are you all right, miss?"
An almost comically resplendent creature stood before Charlotte, in a polonaise of lustrous Prussian blue silk, worn over an elaborately ruffled white underskirt. Her hat was narrow-brimmed and high-crowned, laden with sprays of ornamental grass, against which nestled a stuffed blue-breasted parrot finch, if Charlotte wasn't entirely wrong about her ornithology. She realized that she'd been standing with her back against a 40-foot-high column, her hand over her chest. She dropped that hand.
"Yes, I'm fine. Thank you, ma'am. It's the weather. A bit hot today."
"It has been rather warm lately," said the woman. Her voice was of a startling loveliness, rich as cream, with a barely perceptible hint of huskiness. "Should I ask someone to fetch you a glass of water, miss? Or find you a place to sit down for a minute, in peace and quiet, away from nosy old ladies such as myself?" The woman chuckled at her own joke. Until she did so, Charlotte had thought her in her mid to late 30s, but her mirth revealed webs of crow's feet around her eyes and deep channels to either side of her lips. She was a woman at least 50 years of age. Her money was new. No one who'd been raised to follow the unspoken standards of society, not even a woman with Charlotte's magpie tastes, as Livia called them, would sport so elaborate and fanciful a confection for an outing to the post office. She wore no wedding band, but that, Charlotte decided, was not because she had never been married. The parrot finch on the hat was perched on a little nest made of black crepe. The same material formed a most discreet border around the blue reticule the woman held in her hand. Women only wore black crepe if they had lost their husbands, and the woman here, despite her extravagantly exuberant day dress, wished to honour her late spouse in a subtle manner. Nearly invisible expressions of grief and remembrance woven into her daily attire. Charlotte shook her head at herself, at her ingrained tendency to observe those she came across to the very last detail. She enjoyed it, and she was good at it. But what use was it? What use was a woman with a mind and a temperament that would be odd and borderline worrisome, even in a man? She forced a smile.
"Thank you, ma'am. But I really am quite all right. Nothing is the matter with me at all."
After the woman sashayed away to conduct her business with the post office, her progress followed by all the men and most of the women in a 25-foot radius, Charlotte pulled herself together and left. Perhaps it was nothing more than hunger. Feeling the pinch of imminent penury, she had saved 2 slices of buttered toast from breakfast, but she had wanted to see whether she would still be able to function as usual without eating them for lunch. It had been a long day of walking about London, and she had 2.5 more miles to go before she reached her little room at Mrs. Wallace's. She grew increasingly sure that if she could only set a kettle to boil and put the slices of toast in her stomach where they belonged, she wouldn't feel nearly so dispirited. Not to mention that Miss Whitbread had kindly loaned her 6 magazines. Charlotte had already found 2 interesting travelogue pieces, one on the fjords of Norway and the other about the Canary Islands. A cup of tea, a bite to eat, even if it was from morning, and a chance to forget her troubles by vicariously living another woman's holiday.
"A penny, mum? A penny, please?"
The plaintive cry of a child beggar yanked Charlotte back to the unhappy here and now. The girl was small and hollow-cheeked. Her face and her outstretched hand were coated with grime, her frock such a hodgepodge of brown and grey patches that Charlotte couldn't tell what its original colour had been. But it was the woman holding on to the girl's shoulder who made Charlotte's chest constrict. She had seen beggars in London, but never one like this. The mother wore a black patch over one eye, her other eye the milky blue of the blind. Her face had the vacantness of a North Sea beach in the dead of winter, her arms held close to the sides of her body, the stiffness of
of a marionette. She did not look defeated. To look defeated was to suggest that one had recently strived for something. This woman was drained. Whatever hope and energy she'd once possessed, long ago permanently depleted. The husk that she'd become was far more frightening than the sight of the down-on-their-luck but still saucy beggars Charlotte was more accustomed to seeing, ones who accosted their passers-by with a combination of pathos and bravado.
"A penny for me supper, Mum."
The little girl, not yet entirely diminished by life, asked again. Charlotte opened her reticule and pulled out not only a coin, but the two slices of toast, wrapped in brown paper.
"Here's a sixpenny bit for you. You look after your mum. Make sure she has her supper too."
The little girl looked with incredulity at the coin that had been dropped into her palm. She raised her face to Charlotte, let go of her mother's hand, and wrapped her arms around her benefactor. And only then did she accept the toasts. Charlotte walked on, feeling a little less in despair. Her relief that she could still do something for someone evaporated before the display windows of Atwell and Dewsbury, pharmaceutical chemists. She had never walked so much in her entire life. Her feet were in agony. She probably couldn't afford to buy plasters for her blisters, but at least she could inquire into their prices. She patted the hidden pocket on her skirt. In her reticule she kept only minor change, but in her pocket she had a pound note. Mrs. Wallace's place seemed safe enough, and the lock on Charlotte's door was sturdy. But what if the place burned down while Charlotte was out seeking employment? She didn't want to lose all her money, along with all her other worldly possessions. The pound note in her pocket served as a crude form of insurance. But it was not there. Through the broadcloth of her dress, she couldn't sense the small but very real presence of that precious piece of paper, folded into a square. Surely she was mistaken. She dug her fingers harder against the fabric. Nothing. All she felt was the bulk of her petticoat, and beneath that, the form of her limb. The little beggar girl who had embraced her. Charlotte should have known. She should have known that instant something was wrong. The girl hadn't been anywhere near as emaciated as her face would suggest, and she hadn't smelled of the sourness of lack of washing. No. Charlotte should have known before then. The girl hadn't left her mother's hold. It had been the other way around. The mother had signaled her to go for the easy prey. The eye patch hadn't covered some unsightly deformity. It had covered her good eye, the black cloth thin enough for her to make out something of her surroundings in good daylight. Charlotte was vaguely aware that she was drifting along the street. At some point she might have entered Mrs. Wallace's boarding home. Did someone attempt to speak to her? She had no idea, nor could she be sure whether she had responded. She did remember locking the door of her room before she lifted up a wide band of lace ruffle on her skirt to check the opening of the pocket. It had two buttons, both securely fastened when she'd left the house. Now one button was open, leaving more than enough room for small nimble fingers to reach inside and extract the pound note, which accounted for nearly 40% of her remaining funds. All at once she became aware that someone was banging on her door. "Miss Holmes! Miss Holmes!" She opened the door to Mrs. Wallace's resident sycophant.
"Yes, Miss Turner?"
"Miss Holmes, are you suffering from deafness? I spoke to you downstairs. You didn't even react. And I've been knocking for at least 2 minutes now.
Is everything all right?"
"Mrs. Wallace would like a word with you in her parlour at the earliest possible moment," said Miss Turner, with a smug mysteriousness. Why would Mrs. Wallace wish to speak with Charlotte? She was paid up until the end of next week, and she had come nowhere near the house rules, let alone broken any.
"Certainly. I'll be right down."
At the far end of the corridor was a simple galley, open for 2 hours every afternoon, where Mrs. Wallace's